Welcome to another episode of The Suspendables with funny man Jungle Jim Jerome and retired NHL star Russ Cortinel.
Here's Cortinel. He scores! Cortinel speeding in!
Each week they unleash their raw, stripped-down, unfiltered opinions on all things hockey and maybe other stuff too. Who knows? Inside stories, absolutely. Outrage, guaranteed. Offside, for sure. And always plenty of laughs. Strap in. The Suspendables is coming at you right now.
Hi again, everybody. Jungle Jim Jerome and Russ Cortinel coming at you with another show of The Suspendables. Today, we step aside for an interview we did with Kelly Chase. How should I put it? Well, like this. You are about to get absolutely drilled, and I mean speed bagged, with story after story from his days in the league. I'm not sure it can be any more entertaining than it was. Buckle up, baby. The next 90 minutes are going to take you on a ride of some of the best stories, hands down, you've ever heard. Enjoy. And I'll tell you what, Russ. I hate when people are funnier than I am, okay? And then I connected up with you, and you're funnier than me. And now the guest we're going to bring on is funnier than anybody, so I'm in all sorts of trouble. And we got Kelly Chase on the line. How are you, Kelly?
I'm great. What do you guys have going here? Like, what is this shit you guys are trying to pull off anyway? Russ doesn't have enough jobs. He's got to have a podcast to tell you about him too. Or is this, you know what this is? I guarantee you that there's somehow this is so that he can do advertising for some company that he owns.
There you go. Yeah. See, I tell you, Russ, he's just saying all the shit that I really believed. Okay. But I was afraid to say it.
Finally, Jimmy's got a freaking wingman. He's been getting the shit kicked out of him for 43 shows.
Yeah, this is our 44th show, I think, Kelly, and he has been just trying to annihilate me, okay? And I got the go-to, okay, Kelly? Because one of the deals about you, Kelly, was I was reading some stuff online today and about the verbal barbs, right, that Kelly Chase could give a guy on the ice. And Russ always is kicking the shit out of me, and then I just say this. Hey, how's that Stanley Cup you won? Oh, fuck. No, you didn't. Oh, no, you didn't. How's it going, Kelly? How are you?
Wait a second. Does that stack up against the one that you won?
Well, that's true. Listen.
Is that what you meant?
Listen.
I mean, is that the premise of this?
You know full well that Gretz's coattails are long, and I was the first one on them, okay? I was the first one on those things. So I got four cups, okay? I got four cups. How are you doing, Kelly? Where do we find you now? What's going on in your life? Let us catch up.
I'm in the midst of a renovation in St. Louis, so I'm at our place in. We have a little place there, and we have a place in Nashville. So I'm in Nashville right now because, it seems like it's as good a place as any to be out quarantined right now. It doesn't really matter as long as the house has got a couple set TVs in it, so you can keep away from some of the other customers and clientele in the house.
Sure.
I.e. my sons and sometimes my wife. It works out pretty well.
That's a good, yeah. So my dad used to say, anything that could come along that keeps you away from your wife for a couple hours is a good thing. What's Nashville all about? You're with Discovery, right? Russ has told us this.
Yeah, Russ and I are both working for them. Actually, Russ and I had a real, really good couple summers at Gosser, both in the sales side of it and also having some laughs with one another. And so me being in Nashville now and taking this gig as a full-time kind of a thing, it was sort of, I tried to convince him to come down. I can't break him away.
No.
I can't break him away, man. I don't know what it is, but he won't bite yet, but he's exactly what we need down here. He'd be good in cowboy boots. He's cleaned the shit out of his boots before, you know. He played in Notre Dame, so.
Chaser, I mean, I love the invitation, but Harris didn't move to Maui for 3.5 years with me when I took the job over there. And when I mentioned Nashville, she said, not a fucking chance. But I love Nashville. I bet you if I got her there, she'd like it.
She'd love it. They'd love it. Yeah. Well, I'm going to work on that.
If you could get her there. The only reason Russ would ever get the only qualifier to get Russ anywhere, Kelly, is we have to go to your wine cellar and make sure it's 1,200 bottles or more.
The other motivator is cash, and so I think he'd do real well in this market. Although, I mean, nobody's looking for their third or fourth house in this economy right now. But right. I can tell you that if anybody could sell him one, it'd be Rusty.
It would be. That's true. Tell us. Tell us. Speaking of Stanley Cups, you're probably still. It's probably still hung over from St. Louis winning. I know. You know. Obviously, you were a big part of that team. And
well, we went blue.
We went blue.
tell me, because Holly's a great buddy of yours, and we're going to get him on one day. And I love the Brett Hull stories. That whole thing, we went blue. I think I saw you on stage. Were you right there when all that shit happened?
No, the best part about that story is Doug Armstrong was just livid, and he goes, he goes, get up there and get him off the stage. I go, I'm not getting him off the stage. I mean, Matt, what do you think would be worse? Do you think it would be worse nowadays looking back at what Holly did or me trying to wrestle with him to get him off the stage and him telling me, like, what do you think would look stupider?
Yeah.
I'm like, not a chance, man. Like, what the hell is everybody so fucking worked up about? I told you it was going to be the biggest party in the city. Jesus Christ, they haven't won since 67, and they're worried about me being drunk? Holy shit.
I love that impression. That's unbelievable.
Oh, my God. Don't worry. I'll be fine.
And that's typical of him, right? And that's him, right? All the way, right through.
He goes, sure. It was a big deal, he said. And now they're selling shirts that say we went blue.
Tell the story, Chaser, and I'm sure Russ will have a question or two. You got to tell the story, Chaser, about when Holly was a front office guy and he didn't have his press pass trying to get in past the security guy. Do you remember that story?
Well, actually what happened.
He was a player, wasn't he?
No, we got the security and they had changed the security. What happened was we got to the back door to go in, and they had brought, you know, they had changed security to, they put the dogs and everything down there where they were going to have security. So Holly was, we were coming to the game one night, and, you know, he wasn't a player anymore. We weren't playing. We were just, you know, working for the team. So we went down, and he got to the back entrance to drive down the ramp, and now there's a guy standing there. There's never a guy till you pulled in the garage. And the guy said, can I help you? He says, I don't think so. And the guy says, he goes, are you with the Blues? He goes, I am the fucking Blues. And drives right by the guy and leaves the guy standing there. And the guy is like, fuck, he's on his two-way going, oh, someone just blew by me. Someone just went by me. So, I mean, you know, three security guards and a cop standing at the bottom of the thing. And then you hear the guy go, ah, it's Brett Hull. And you could just see there was a pause. And the guy goes, oh, Jesus, am I fired?
Oh, man.
I am the fucking Blues. I said, hey, you probably could have been a little quieter about that. He goes, Jesus Christ, there's a 30-foot statue out in front of the place and a street with my name on it. So.
You must have so many stories, but one of my favorite was at the Gretzky Fantasy Camp, which you were a big part of for so many years, and so was Russ. And Holly's there, and it's a scotch and cigar night, okay? And if you know Brett Hull at all, right, Chaser, he just looks like he has this I'm disgusted with everyone and everything look on his face all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Yeah. And he's sitting there telling this story.
And he usually is.
Yeah, right. Right. And he's smoking his cigar. He looks great. He's got a tumbler of scotch. And he's talking about this charity thing he got involved in with Mark Cuban when he was in Dallas. And it was called Mystery at 30,000 Feet. Cuban put this thing together. You do a blind auction. They take six couples or something. You jump on Cuban's plane. You get up in the air. And then he tells you, we're going to South America. And only Brett Hull, okay, he goes, Anyway, I got myself involved in this fucking thing that I gotta go to. I'm up in the air. We land somewhere down south in the jungle, and I'm looking, and there's this lady listening to him, right? We're all sitting around, and he's getting a little crazy. And he says, I'm looking around when we land for like the Westin Hotel or something. And the guy goes, no, there's no hotel. You're staying up here. And it's about 1,000 feet of stairs, he goes, that I have to climb up. The line that knocked everyone out, he goes, so it's about 1,000,000 degrees. And I'm walking up the stairs, sweating like a gay guy eating a hot dog. Okay, what's this fucking line?
Thing with him is he doesn't bat an eye, right? So he's looking around and he says it and he goes, what? You know, just like, not what? I mean, I don't even know what you're talking about. What's the big deal?
Yeah.
That's what would come out of his mouth.
I know.
He knows he's brutal tonight. He told Gretz at the practice one time, Gretz fired a pass over to him and he just kept skating and Gretz was pissed off, right? And he goes, what the hell are you doing? He goes, you're supposed to be the greatest player that ever played. Put the fucking passes on my tape.
Of all those years, Chaser, I know Russ has got a million stories a week. You must have some favorites. You must have some favorite stories. Not necessarily about Holly, but some of your all-time faves. Lay them on us.
I played with some really, really good guys and some really fun guys. And I was telling Garth Butcher, Butchie's one of the funniest guys you've ever been around. And, he's got this
really
quiet, kind of candid humor about him. But he had some lines on the ice sometimes that were just, epic. But I was telling, he used to get Stu Grimson, who's a really good friend of mine. And he wasn't when we played, but he used to get Stu so mad at him, right? He used to tell him, Stu was a fairly religious guy. And he used to tell him that he couldn't be a born again Christian because there was no pictures in the Bible.
And, come on.
There's no way you're a born again Christian. Because there's no pictures in the Bible. So he used to say, you wouldn't curse at the time. He'd be like, hey, Butch, shut your mouth, Butch. Shut up. Shut up. And Butch, you'd be stretching. And I'd be thinking, the whole time I'd be thinking, you know what? You know what's going to happen here? What's going to happen here is I am going to end up having to fight with Stu Grimson, as pissed off as he is, because Butch is just trying to get him mad. And he would do it all the time. He'd tell him, he said, Stu, I know why you're, I finally figured out why your parents named you Stu. They weren't smart enough to spell stupid. Butch was one of the best, and he had this wit about him, a fan yelling at him one time, and he just signed a big contract in St. Louis, and he was the captain of our team, and some fan was all over him in Winnipeg, in the old rink, just giving it to him constantly, and he was just standing there kind of ignoring the guy. Finally, the guy goes, hey, Butcher, what does that T on your shoulder stand for? He says, cash, lots of it.
you can't write it, right? You just can't write it, right?
He was a hell of a good guy. And then I played with Jeff, Russ's brother, and him and Mark Bergevin tried to outdo themselves all the time. They tried to one up one another with the jokes, and they played more pranks on each other and on other guys, but they used to terrorize poor Rudy Poschek. And Rudy had gotten this new car. I think it was an Infiniti, and those two dumbasses, every morning they would come in and they would steal his keys and they would just touch the key to the skate sharpener.
Oh no.
So the sparks would fly a little bit. And every day that car got harder and harder to start until he fought with that ignition for about a week. And then he took the car back. And those two guys were pissing their pads laughing because
Rudy, what's wrong with the car? He was bragging about his car. What's wrong with the car, Rudy? I don't know, son. It won't start. So they guys from Infinity were over trying to fix the car in the parkade at practice. And then they took and put the thing up on. They put popcorn inside in the sunroof and filled it up with popcorn. And, I mean, you know, that smell, you're not getting out of there, right? And those two idiots, like, they just terrorized the piss out of them.
Hey, Kelly, which Sansone did Jeff screw with?
Well, the last one that I knew of that he did was he put a dead mouse in his cowboy boot.
Oh, no.
You know, and he fought with that boot for a minute or two to get it on. And then when he got it on, it just squished inside his boot. And he's like, what the hell's in there? And then he come out with that mouse on it. And he's dancing around like a small child in the middle of the living room. And Jeff would just mess with him. But he was relentless. Like, if Jeff got to you. I mean, Mark Bergevin, funnier than hell. Mark Bergevin played one of the all-time jokes on Larry Plohe. Larry Plohe had come in on a joke with Jeff,
right?
And said that Mark Bergevin. They had this talk to Mark Bergevin, who, by the way, was one of the ultimate team guys, like one of the ultimate team players. Everyone loved him. Played for his teammates, but was just a character guy. Like, everyone loved him.
Right.
And so he called Burge in and said he was told and made up this thing saying that he was picking on Jamie Rivers. And if he couldn't be more of a team guy, he was going to have to trade him. And I mean, nothing would piss Bergevin off more than to say that he wasn't a team guy. He was just rattled. Right.
Yeah.
And then he realized he started yelling back at Larry Plohe. And then Larry started laughing, and Bersh had a hot pack on, and he threw it at Larry. And he just, like, he was saying, you son of, and then we were all on the other side of the door because Jeff had set it up, and we were all listening, and we were laughing our asses off. Well, he come flying out of that room. He goes, okay, I'll get you. So we used to get the press notes all the time just at our door of our hotel room in the morning. The young kid working in PR would get up, and he'd photocopy, you know, 30 sheets of the press clips around the league, and then you'd have all the newspapers at your disposal right at your door of every morning when you got up in your hotel room.
Right.
So it was the night that Marty McSorley had hit Brashear with a stick, and it was all over the news, and, you know, and so we had played in Anaheim, and we'd watched the game. We'd watched the highlights a few times. But that was back in the day. We had, you know, a lot of the guys would kind of come and meet us out in L.A. and Anaheim that were friends of ours.
Right.
Well, one of the biggest fans in hockey was this girl named Alicia Klass. Seymour Butts was her stage name. Porn star. So she's in this same restaurant right by the hotel that we're in. And she is just, so they send her over to, you know, the coaches and they, you know, Quenneville and she's like over there talking to them and they're like embarrassed, but they don't want to be rude. She's a huge Blues fan and she's over talking to them all. And so Mark Bergevin in the morning, the press clippings come around and you read the press clippings and it says that Larry Plohe was unavailable for comment as he was entertaining at his table,
oh, no.
St. Louis native and porn star, oh, Alicia Klass.
Oh, no.
So the coaches are like, oh, my God. Let's said coaches and management, Larry Plohe. So they were like in a panic. They're like, what the hell? Quenneville, I think, caught on, right, you know, fairly quickly. But
right.
As it turns out, Larry showed up at the rink, and he was looking for this reporter that had wrote the story. And he went around, we seen him walk in and we watched him go around and like he had gone in the coach's office and he said to the coaches, he's just like, what the hell is this guy thinking? Like, what am I supposed to tell my wife?
Yeah.
Like that never happened. Like, what am I supposed to say? And he's going on and on about how, you know, like, and my wife, and he goes in the public and my wife, like, what am I going to say to my wife? And he just kept bringing up Wendy. What am I going to say to Wendy? Right.
Yeah.
Well, as it turns out, he come around the rink, he found that reporter, and he just took off and made a beeline for him going around the rink in San Jose because we'd gone on to San Jose that day. And I'll tell you what, you want to talk about the craziness of Larry Plohe, who is not a real aggressive guy.
Right.
He was going crazy on this reporter, was looking at him like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, I don't even know what the fuck you're talking about. And here, Mark Bergevin had got up and he had got and slipped his own story in the press notes and made the kid staple this extra page in about Larry Plo and the management not commenting on the Brashear McSorley incident because they were with the porn star, and it was never actually in the newspaper. And Larry went crazy, and he was giving it. And finally, Burge, where he was saying, "Burge, you got to say something. Like, you got to say something. I mean, come on." And he finally, Burge, he's banging his stick on the ice, and Larry Plo turns around because he's just berating this poor bastard that doesn't even know what's going on.
Right.
And Burge goes, "Hey, Larry. And Larry Plo turns around. He goes, "Don't fuck with the bird." And the whole team locks and laughing. He realized that Burge had pulled one over on him, and he was pissed off because he had got him earlier.
But relieved.
Like, but I mean, like, but I mean, like, honestly, like it's your freaking GM. It's not like he did it to another player. He's
right.
Going after the GM. I'm like, that takes some balls.
Right. It's like, as you think of some more stories, and Russ may have a question, it's like Semenk, you know, of course, who was your ilk, you know, you were the tough guy club, and Semenk was playing then, and he kept missing practice, right? It was back in his blurry days, and Semenk and I used to run together quite a bit, and he keeps missing practice, and he's late, and Slats doesn't know what to do, the GM, of course, of the Oilers, and he's saying, "Fuck, I can't send the guy, I need him, right? He's our guy, right?" And so he calls in Mess and Gretz and Kevin Lowe and says, "You guys fucking talk to him, okay? I don't know what to do, okay? He keeps being late, and there's no way I can send him down. Any other guy, I would. I'd fucking get him out of here in a second." And so Gretz says, "Okay, I'll talk to him." And they read the riot act to Semenk. And they go, "Semenk, fucking phone us. Do something. You got to make it to practice on time." And Slats said, if you don't this time, I got no choice. I'm going to have to fucking send you down if he does it again." And so Gretz reads in the act, Kevin does, Mess. The next day, they're leaving the hotel. You know, the bus is out front. They're on the road. And the bus is loading up. And there's no Semenk, right? And they're everyone's looking around. Gretz is holding his head. Slats is going wide-eyed, going, "Where the fuck is he? He's supposed to be..." Now it's late. Okay, now it's late. 8:05. They're supposed to leave at 8. 8:10, quarter after, a cab comes ripping up in the front of the hotel. Semenk is putting his shirt on. There's two broads in the back seat, and he flies out of the cab and he just runs onto the bus, right? And everyone's there, and he stands at the front of the bus, and hears this dead silence, and Slats looking at him, and Semenk just goes, "Didn't everyone make it with a couple of stewies last night? What's up?" Yeah. That's it. I mean, fuck. He just, who would think of that? Huh? You know,
that's so good.
I mean, he was one of the funniest guys, right, Chaser? I mean, Semenk was...
Oh, you know what he said? Well, I was at Gretz's fantasy camp, and we got on a roll in the casino the night before, and we were just having a great time.
Right.
And Semenk came by and he was watching us win. And we were winning. Like, it was awesome.
I was there.
There was a good group.
I was there.
Great. Yeah. Right. Right. We went on that roll. So in the morning I got, Semenk comes over to me and he says, "What time did you get in? What time did you shut her down? Last night, kid." He's got his arm around me, you know, big, big Sammy, just lovable.
Right.
I said, "Fuck." I said, we went at it till 6 a.m. I go, I got to my room at 6:15 a.m. He goes, "Fuck, I wish I had that kind of discipline when I played."
He was so good. You know, Kelly, I don't know if you know this, but I played with him in Toronto his last game in the NHL. And I was with my mom, who you know, my mom and Cliff, who you knew well.
Yeah.
And we're in Vancouver, and we're at some pub, the four of us, maybe my younger brother Bruce was there, and he stands up and he goes, "Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. I quit." And I went, "Okay," and he left. And then the next morning, he wasn't at practice, and he's like, he flew home, he quit. That was it.
Yeah, yeah.
I was with him the last night he ever played in the NHL.
Do you know that he was, and I was at an event for Andy, Glennie Anderson. They were retiring his jersey in Edmonton. He phoned me up. He said, and Andy, when he has a party, okay, usually it's one night. Andy's is like six nights, okay? He rents a fucking suite. He's got a million people coming in. And we're doing this dinner and the night before the jersey retirement. And Semenka's there, and I'm getting up and cracking a few jokes and picking on guys. And Semenka gets up to speak, you know, in his low drawl. And Dave Hunter is there in the back of the room. And now Dave is weighs about fucking three and change, okay? Hunts has put on. He hasn't drank in years, but he weighs 300, okay? And Semenka gets up and he's saying, Andy, thank you very much. It's such a pleasure to be a part of, such an exclusive affair, Andy. And it's nice you're here, and it's a beautiful evening. And Dave Hunts, I can't say how exceptional is what you've done over your life, and you clearly have fought the demons of anorexia. I mean, he was Johnny Carson brilliant, you know, like he was just, he was hilarious, man. He was absolutely hilarious. Tell us, Chaser, what about incidences with coaches in your life? What Russ has told us many stories about, who was the guy in Toronto, Russ, who was so quotable, the coach in Toronto when Lehman,
John Brophy.
We've heard so many great stories about Brophy. How about you, Kelly, with coaches that you've had in your career?
You know what? I've had there's always something funny that's happened with coaches, you know, but I quote my buddy and I, you know, my buddy Daryl Lubinick, he was the general manager for us in coach in Saskatoon.
Right.
And probably one of the reasons, literally believed in somebody that wasn't good and wasn't, I never got drafted and he kept me. And I mean, this guy, I love him. He's responsible for me getting an opportunity to play. So, and unfortunately just lost his wife. But he would say some shit that first of all, you have to understand, this man loved Wendell Clark. Like, Wendell played for the Saskatoon Blades. Wendell could do anything. Like, right. he just, you know, it was Wendell. I mean, it was his boy, you know. And
right.
And he would say, you fucking guys, you don't want to win. You got to be more like me. I want to win. He goes, give me 23 fucking Kevin Kaminskys and Wendell Clarks and I'll fucking beat you at anything. Ping pong, racquetball, fuck, you name it. I'll beat you because they want to win. Like, he goes, I go fishing with my daughter. She catches the first fish. I cut her fucking line because I want to catch the first fucking fish.
Oh no!
How do you say shit like that all the time? Kosher. He would say, "Okay, boys, I'll tell you what I'm going to do this week. I'm going to sacrifice my body for you fuckers. Okay, everybody's going to go home and be in for curfew, right. And I'm going to do all the drinking and fucking for the whole team for the whole fucking playoff. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do it for everyone. I'm going to sacrifice. Okay, fucking." Kosher, if I cut your head open, a pussy'd fall on the floor. If that's all you think about, Kosher, like, you
know. Oh, man.
Oh, yeah. He would say some shit sometimes that was just unbelievable. So he used to make us laugh, though, man. He goes, fucking just playing the old choir again, eh, boys? The old dee da dee da dee. And you never move the fucking puck up. Dee da dee da dee. Dee da dee, like a fucking choir. Dee da dee, dee da dee, and then pretty soon, dee da dee da dem. Dee da dee da dem. That's how it goes. Fucking dee, you move the fuck. Yeah. Dee da dee da dem.
You got to tell the Gordie Howe story. Oh my God, it's my favorite.
Yeah. Well, I was lucky that I went to camp as a 18-year-old. I was undrafted, and Bruce Hamilton was a. That owns Kelowna now is a scout for the Hartford Whalers. And he got in touch with the Blades and said, you know, I think, you know, we want Chase to come to camp. And, you know, we could use some more bodies. And obviously was doing Luby a favor. Luby wanted me to go to a training camp and he gave me a chance. So I went to camp as an 18-year-old in Hartford. So I get to the gate in Toronto and there's Gordie Howe standing at the gate and I cannot fucking believe him. He's right there. And I mean, it's Gordie Howe. I can't even
So I got up enough nerve and I mustered it up and I said, I walked over to him. I said, Mr. Howe, my name's Kelly Chase. And I just want to say thank you for all of the things that you've done for all us kids in Saskatchewan. And basically he goes, sit down, lad. So I sit down to talk to him. And about 2 minutes after I sit down, they cancel the flight. And they tell us, the lady called, but she calls Gordy up into the podium. She goes, Mr. Howe, could you come here for a second? And we're sitting right beside the little ticket counter there. So she goes, Mr. Howe, we're going to have to cancel a flight from mechanical issues. So she goes, you're not going to take one out tonight. But she goes, we'll get you a hotel room and make sure that you're taken care of. She goes, are you two traveling together? And he goes, yes. He goes, yes, we are. So the first night of my pro career, I room with Gordy Howe.
No.
In the hotel in the Toronto airport. Okay. Gordy's got me a room. He goes, throw your bag in. I throw my bag in the room and come on, we'll go have a beer. So we go downstairs and he's ordering a steak and I probably had a hamburger. I wasn't old enough to drink, but I certainly knew my way around the bars already. So I had one and I just couldn't believe it. I was like, you could send me back home in the morning. I was so good enough. Like, right.
Sure.
He's saying, listen, son, he goes, nobody's really gone to bat for you. Like he goes, these scouts, he goes, you know, they work all year and then they will draft guys. And then, you know, and then they come to camp and they're going to be going for their guys. So you got to make sure they know who you are when you're there. Like you got to, you know, try and make yourself visible so that everyone knows who you are. And they say that, you know, if you hit guys, they'll say, well, the hitters, you know, he scored a goal, or the hitter, you know, made a great play, made a nice pass, or the passer fought, or, you know, get your gear off and skate naked down the ice, and they say the naked guy scored or whatever it is. They got to know who you are. I said, okay. So I missed the morning skate.
Oh no.
I went in the afternoon because we'd been late getting in. We didn't get in the night before. So I got to the second session and each rookie had a veteran player that he had to room with. And I had Paul Lawless. And I went out on the ice my first skate and I got in a fight with this kid and, you know, I did pretty well. I thought this guy was older than me and bigger than me. And I thought, well, I hung in there and, you know, I got that out of the road. And so I went back to my room and then I ended up fighting Bill Root. And again, I fought Billy Root, who was a journeyman defenseman that everybody on the team loved. I didn't know that. I didn't know Bill Root. I knew who he was, but I didn't know him. And so I guess what happened was the older guys were pissed off that I had tuned up Billy Root.
Right.
But I got up in the morning and I went to go to the rink and Paul Lawless says to me, he says, hey, bud, keep your head up out there today. And I said, oh, yeah. Don't worry. You know, right off the farm, eh? No fucking clue. And I didn't realize that I was going to have my hands full for the rest of the camp. So I went out on the ice and before the puck dropped, I got punched right in the face.
Oh, no.
And guy comes after me and gets in a fight. And I'm not even in the fight. Like, I don't even get my both gloves off. And I've already been beaten. And I'm so pissed off. And I'm so embarrassed. And I'm not even now thinking about hockey. I'm just thinking about I'm going to get this guy for it because I don't want to be embarrassed.
Right.
So I go out on the ice. I'm yelling at the guy and they're telling me to sit down. And then I go on the ice when the Zambonis come out. This is my next time when I'm on the ice with him. And the Zamboni's driving around cleaning the ice and everyone's all kind of standing around. And this guy's leaning on the net down at the one end. And I just go down and trail the Zamboni. And then when the Zamboni makes the swing, I come around and he's sitting there talking to Steve Weeks. And I spear this guy, drop my gloves, and I just beat the shit out of this guy in the crease while the Zamboni's going around, right? So the whole rink is piled on top of me trying to, you know, and my own teammates are thinking, where did we find this fucking
room? Where's this guy from?
Where's this guy from, right? Send him back to Saskatoon or wherever he came from and get him out of here. And so, you know, of course, you can imagine when you do that to a veteran player, what's going to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
So I didn't think it through real well, fellas. So what goes on now is yeah. is that everybody and their dog is coming after me on the ice, right?
Yeah.
So I end up fighting with Shane Turla, and I fight with a guy by the name of Chris Brandt, and I fight with a guy by the name of Sean Cronin.
Oh, fuck, I remember him. Yeah.
Yeah, Cronin the Barbarian. So we, this whole deal goes on, and I've now fought three times in the second half of my first shift, first skate in the morning.
Nice.
So I've three times in the second shift of it, twice if you call the first one where I got punched out a fight. So now I'm like, everyone in the rink is like, what in the, where is this kid from? Like, what is, he's the fucking
maniac
nuisance right now, yeah. Right? So I'm going off the, and I'm pissed off and I'm embarrassed and I got anxiety and I have no man strength. I'm just so pissed off that this guy suckered me. I'm fucking going to lose it.
Right.
And so, I shower and no one will even kind of look at me on my own team. And I'm like, all right. So I walk in out of the ring and this big old fucking arm comes around me right in front of the bus and it's Gordy Howe. And he says, hey kid, they fucking know who you are now. And you know what he did was? He stood in front of that bus and he talked to me so that every single person at that training camp knew that I was his friend. And when I left that rink, I was so proud and I was so happy. And I was like, and I got back to the hotel and his son Marty called me on the phone and he said, Kelly, yeah, it's Marty Howe. I said, hi, Marty. He said, listen, we're going out in the boat to check some lobster traps. And I was wondering if you'd like to come for a ride in the boat. My dad said you had a rough afternoon. I said, sure, I'd like that. And I got out there and there was a bunch of the veterans, of course, on the boat, you know, Quenville and Ronnie Francis and Kevin Dineen and all these, you know, veteran players. And Gordy made sure I was set up. So, you know, once you're in the NHL and you're playing, you get this whole like feeling of, you know, sense of camaraderie with different groups, right? I always felt like I could go up to Gordy Howe and say anything after that. Like he did something for me I will never forget. And it wasn't just that he did something for me and he was an NHL player. It was fucking Gordy Howe. Like it, you know what I mean? Like it was,
yeah,
the Babe Ruth of hockey. Like he was so good to people, but he was such an imposing figure. And it was the fact that I just felt good that I was able to, I'm so proud it was him that, you know, that kind of helped me out because it made a huge difference. My son plays junior hockey and I told him the exact same thing. I go, you go to camp, whatever the things are, if you're not having your best game, whatever the things are, there are little things to make yourself stand out, whether it's sliding in front of shots, you know, hitting, getting, winning face-offs, all the little things that go, that kid that wins the face-offs all the time made a nice pass. Or that, you know, it's the things that you have to do that are the intangibles. And I heard it from the greatest player, you know, of generations. And so, and he was my hero.
The other story that you told me that I absolutely barfed, I was laughing so hard, was you in a hotel with Bobby Hull and going back to the room late. It's the best. It's the fucking best. You got to tell that story.
Well, you know what? I've got a, you know, some, you know, you get to meet guys like that are of that ilk of player and you're, you know, and I mean, look, I got to meet Bobby Hull and the night I meet him, he ends up going out for a few cocktails with Brett, believe it or not. I know it's hard to believe, boys.
Shocker.
But we end up taking Bobby back to the hotel with us to the Drake in Chicago. And Big Bob is going to spend the night. So Brett goes over to the counter to get him a hotel room. And I said, sorry, Mr. Hull, we're sold out. It gets the restaurant convention in Chicago and we just have no rooms available, unfortunately. So I'm sorry. And he's like, yes, you don't get anything. She's like, nothing. Jesus Christ. Well, get him a cot. Can we get a cot? So they're sending a cot up to the room for, you know, and we get to the fucking door of the elevator. And as you know, Rusty, you guys used to stay at the Drake. They have the old fellas that run the elevators, like 24/7. There's someone in the elevator pushing your floor number. He's wearing white gloves. He's like a concierge. And he looks at Bobby Hall, this guy, he's, I don't know, probably in his 70s. And he looks at Bobby Hall and he just about shits his pants. He cannot believe, he's like, Mr. Hall, how you doing, young man? You know, Big Bob, how you doing, young man? Young fella, that's what he said. How you doing, young fella? And the guy said, I'm good. He says, press one. And well, he's like, we're on four. He goes, press one, goddammit. So he the old guy is pressing one. Holly goes, we're on the fourth floor. And Big Bob tells him to shut up. And the next thing you know, we're on one. He goes, hold the door. So the guy's holding the door. And there's a seat. There's seats on the, in the elevator, too, by the way. A little bench seat at the back. So Holly's sitting down, of course. And Big Bob is comes back to the elevator. He's rattling around. And here he comes onto the elevator. He's got a food tray. He's got a couple pieces of pizza. He's got a couple of chicken wings. He's got a quarter of a clubhouse sandwich.
No.
And he goes, this is how we ate in the old days. He goes, Stan took the even floors. I took the odd. Stan Mikita and him used to raid the food trays in the hallway when they'd come home late when room service was closed, right?
Sure.
So he's telling us that's what him and Stan ate. So Holly's like, put that down. You know, like in other words, he goes, Jesus Christ, well, all the room service wasteful bastards, he's saying. And the next thing, and I'm thinking, holy shit, Bobby Hall, my hero, another hero. He's eating off the food trays in the goddamn hallways, right? So I'm just shaking my head. I get up to the room. I jump into the room, into the bathroom right away so I can get in there and get my teeth brushed. And Big Bob, and they bring the cot up, and I jump into this cot. And Big Bob goes in the bathroom. He's like, comes out and he goes, get yourself into a bed, son. And I said, no. I said, I'll stay here, Mr. Hall. And he goes, all right, suit yourself. And then the next thing you know, he just reaches up and pulls his rug right off his head and
hangs
on the bedpost on my bed. I'm like, I'm about to shit my pants. I'm like, fuck, there's my hero. He just ate off the food trays in the middle of the hallway. And now here he is. He's got his rug hanging on the bedpost of the bed.
Oh,
he's
no.
Bald. I'm like, oh, my God. I'm telling you right now, I about shit.
I got a fucking headache, man. I'm laughing so hard. Before,
fuck, that is funny.
It's so funny. Before you go, Chaser, you were a tough guy in the league. You were your whole life. And did it ever, a couple questions I got for you about that. That was your hand, that was the handle, you know, through your whole career. Did it ever get to a point after that fact, Chaser, that you were, that sort of hung with you? You guys made a mark in the league that people know you as a tough guy. With all the other stuff you did, did that ever bug you? Because you're certainly more than that.
Well, you know what? I mean, look, it was a way for me to make a living in the league. But you know, I mean, I mean, like, if you've seen Ice Guardians, the movie,
I tried to watch it on Netflix last night. It's not there anymore, or was it ever?
Oh yeah, it's there.
It might be American ones. I'm up in Canada. It might be the American one. I'll have to check.
No, I think you should be able to get it because I think they just renewed their agreement with us, as a matter of fact. But it's been very well received. And it's funny because, like, the thing is, I never one time fought for anybody else's entertainment. That's the one thing that used to bug me. People thought it was like a show.
Right.
And
right.
I never did that. I never went out there and said, okay, I'm just going to put on a show for people. Like, that's not what I did that for. I did it because I felt like I was sacrificing something for my teammates because I wanted them to feel more comfortable. I wanted them to be able to feel like they could go and do whatever their skill set was that made them successful and not have to worry about anybody ever bullying them or taking advantage of them. And I just was like, I never I never really, and it never dawned, like I never realized how much it impacted the people around me either, because until that movie came out and I came out of, it was the Toronto Film Festival. We went and premiered, and we had an unbelievable reception from people. And it was, I'll tell you on a side note, we had Luke Gadzik. We had a bunch of guys up there, Riley Cote, Brian McGrattan, mm-hmm. who I thought was unbelievable in it. Guys, you know, some really tough guys. And Wendell was one of the guys that was on the stage at the end for the Q&A. And Luke Gadzik stood up and he said, they said, is there anything that, you know, you would, you know, they asked the question. They introduced the stage and Luke said, before we start, they asked him his first question. He said, before I start, can I just go over and shake Wendell Clark's hand? I just can't believe I'm on stage with Wendell Clark right now. And Brian McGrattan said, sit down, kid. I get to shake his hand first.
Oh, no
kidding. I can't believe I'm up here with him. And it didn't even dawn on me that these guys just idolized Wendell, right? They idolized him.
Right.
And it was so great, you know, to see the camaraderie of the guys that didn't know one another but respected what they all did. But anyways, at the end of the show, I had a girlfriend of mine there. Was with my family, my sister, my wife, my kids, and this girlfriend came over. She was sitting with us, and she said, she was crying. And I said, why are you crying? And she said, because I feel terrible. I'm so sorry I didn't stick up for you. And I said, Candace, what the hell are you talking about? She goes, I hated that you fought. It bothered me so much. And when people would say stuff about it, I never defended you because I never understood it.
Right.
And now I get it.
Right.
And she said, and now I'm so embarrassed. I'm so embarrassed that I didn't defend you because I love you.
Oh,
and
wow.
She said, it just bothers me. And she goes, because you guys were so misunderstood. And I said, hey, don't worry about it. I go, you know, I'm actually glad that the movie made that much of an impact that someone would say that, you know, I mean, if you think about it, it's a pretty strong statement. I said, but I gotta tell you, I go, when I played the game, I never did it for entertainment. And I never, ever, ever give a shit what people thought about what I did.
Oh,
like
wow.
If someone said, what a jackass this guy does, what, you know, look at him all, you know, whether I went and, you know, grab some guy that everyone thought I should have, he wasn't a tough guy or whatever. If I did it, there was a reason why I did. I felt I did it for a reason. And it was a good reason. In my opinion, it was, in my mind, it was a good reason. I had no qualms about beating the shit out of a guy that was 5'5" or,
right.
You know, if I could fight a guy that was 6'4", because if you were 5'5" and you were getting a shit kicking from me, someone on your team was acting like an asshole or you were one of the two. And either way, you had it coming. And if it was one of your teammates, then he better swallow something and smarten up or else you're going to get it again. Because sometimes you can't make a point with big guys.
Right.
Sometimes you got to beat the shit out of a little guy so the big guy actually dawns on him that he's acting like an asshole. So you have to make a point sometimes. And if I had to make a point by grabbing a hold of a little guy, it didn't bother me. And I'm telling you, and I grew up in a place where none of us, I'm not speaking for these guys, but I grew up with Kosher. I grew up with Wendell. We're all from the same place. It wouldn't dawn on one of us to step back from a little, if someone was looking for it and it didn't matter their size. If your mouth was going or your teammates, you were going to get it. And that was it. It never bothered me. I never left the rink going, geez, you know, and I've done some things sometimes that are pretty tough to people, but I'm okay with it. I sleep fine.
What the fuck is with kids who grow up on a farm that they're all so freaking tough and crazy? What's with the farm life? You know, they turn out guys like you. They're fucking nuts.
We don't want to have to go back there. That's probably what it is. You know, they're great places to visit, but it's a hard living.
Right.
Yeah, it's a hard life. It's a great life, but it's a hard life. And it's funny, you know, we all are parents. You see the parents, you go back, you still have a tremendous amount of respect for all of them because we weren't raised by a parent or two. We were raised by the community.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. So, yeah.
You know, like, it's not like, you were representing your entire town. You weren't representing your mom and dad or your sisters and brothers. You had to go back home.
Right.
You know, and those people were the people that raised you, and they're the ones that gave you, you know, they gave you some sort of an upbringing as a community. You know, I mean, if you ran around the rink in Kelvington and acted like an asshole, you're going to have the broom in your hand and you're going to be working, because Les Clark was going to do that. If you were in my hometown, same sort of thing. Like all of the things that we grew up, if you're doing something stupid and you got a kick in the ass from Joe Koser, it was because you were doing something stupid. And your dad didn't go, well, I'll go over and straighten Joe Koser out. He gave you another kick in the ass because Joe Koser had to do it and catch you.
right.
You know, like it just was how it was. Yeah. And so you were community parented. But you also, you know, you had to answer in those small towns to people. You didn't want to embarrass them. And I mean, Joel Quenville told me something one time that was impactful to me. He said, listen, I don't know how to do what you do. Okay. I'm not going to joke, pretend or whatever that I do. But he said, but I'm going to allow you to do it whenever you think and do push the envelope as far as you want to push it. As long as you don't embarrass the team or your teammates, me, your teammates or your family. So if you think that you think you got to go straighten somebody out and you got to do what you got to do, then you go do it. You know, as long as you're okay understanding that, you know, you can't embarrass those three, you know, groups of people. Right. And I appreciated that, because I think there's a lot of coaches that didn't have a grasp on when and where it should be done. And Joel didn't pretend to know it. He just said, here, just turn around and tell me.
Right.
Look, I mean, you turn around and tell me when you think you need to go out there and straighten somebody around. And then if you got to explain it to me later, you know, you have your reasons, then explain it to me. But don't, you know, just don't cost us. That's
right.
All. And,
right.
And I thought it was great. And then, you know, and there was, and, you know, I remember a couple times doing it, like having to turn around and go, I'm going, hey, coach, now would be a real good time for me to go on the ice.
Right.
and I remember saying that too one time when Darian Hatcher was beating the shit out of Brett Hull every game, and he wouldn't fight with me. He's like, you're not even going to play. I'm not fighting with you. You don't even go on the ice. And Darian, as we know, not only was he a good player, he used his size to become a good player because he was such a bloody beast out there, right?
Right.
And so I actually, I just finally had a TV timeout. I had enough, and I told the Dallas bench, I said, I'm going to beat the shit out of Benoit Hogue or Mike Modano, and the next time I'm out on the ice, I'm just going to beat the shit out of one of them, and I don't give a shit what you guys think about it, but I'm just telling you, and you can thank Darian Hatcher. And everyone was yelling at me off their bench. I mean, like Hitch was coaching. He was yelling at me.
Right.
You're not even going to play. Oh, yeah. So Modano and Hogue went out on the ice. We had last change. We were at home. I turned around and told Joel it would be nice if I could get out there.
Right.
And he put me out on the ice. And I just skated out. And Mike Modano had played junior against me. And he was in Prince Albert. And he just said, Chaser, just please leave me the fuck alone. And I grabbed Twister out on the ice with me, and Twister started up some shit.
Yeah.
And the linesman got all distracted. I told Twister, just stir up some shit here.
Yeah.
And the linesman go racing over to Tony Twist right away as soon as that happens, right?
Yeah.
And while he had them distracted, I pulled Benny out of the pile, and when I got in the fight, and I don't know if he got his eye... His orbital bone broke, but his jaw broke for
Jesus.
Sure. So after the game, the reporters come in the room and they're asking me, of course, about the incident and, you know, insinuating that I probably should have picked on somebody that was more of a fighter and so on and so forth. And I just, you know, said, well, I don't feel bad for, you know, like I'm okay with it. I can live with myself. I said, you know, I said, if we're going to start pointing fingers at anybody, actually we could point down the road at Benny. For Benny's problems to Darian Hatcher, who's been picking on Brett Hull every game. abusing him, cross-checking him. He's got an aluminum stick, and he's pounding on Brett Hull. And I go, and I'm tired of it. So every time it happens, I'm going to have to go and straighten out Benoit Hogue and Mike Modano. And that's why that's going to work for the rest of the year.
That's fabulous.
And I'll tell you what, we went into Dallas, and the very next game, Patch came right after me.
Oh, he did? Well, there you go.
And I said, okay. Yeah, and I said, that's good, because now his focus is, you know, going to be on me again. And now my job is not obsolete. And by the way, Benoit Hogue and Mike Modano are going to be a little less, you know, they're probably going to talk to Darian and say, Darian, maybe tonight, like, don't pound on Brett Hull.
Yeah, right.
You're gonna not tonight. Wait till playoffs. Wait till, you know, whatever it may be. So, you know, I always felt like I don't apologize for any. I don't give a shit. I really don't. I don't feel bad. That's how the game was played. And the one thing that I'm really proud of, and I've been like this, and I believe that I'm like this anyway, is I look, I'm an aggressive guy, and I know that in general, but it really pisses me off when people are getting bullied.
Right.
And I just stopped the bullying. That's what we were there for. We were there to stop the bullying, and I have no problem with
right.
it. Doesn't bother me a bit.
Attaboy. When I played with Clarkie in Toronto, and after the when shit would happen and somebody was doing that to me, you know, bullying me, I guess, he would say, Rusty, count to three. And if the shit starts, he goes, count to three. And if I'm not there, I'm fighting somebody else. You're on your own.
Perfect.
It's 100% right. Like, the thing of it is that it was a much tougher way to play the game now. Like, I don't like to get into who's better and what era or whatever, but like, is it a faster game now? Absolutely. The athletes now are so damn good and such a high pace, but the sense of, like, to me, and I'm just throwing this out there for thought, like, can you imagine how many goals Wayne Gretzky would have? Like, Brett Hull would score in this day and age where you can't pound on him in front of the net. All he has to do is get open, and you can't get on his hand. And all he has to do is get open.
Right. Right.
By the way, we're going to, for Wayne, by the way, we're going to play 3-on-3 in overtime.
Oh, right. Yeah, right.
Oh, but wait, we're not done. Yeah. We're not done. Here's what else we're going to do. We're going to fucking take the ice, and we're going to clean it every 7 minutes for you, Wayne.
Right.
So that you can really fucking embarrass us on top of it all, okay? Yeah, we're going to make sure that it's good and dusted off for you, too, when you come out. So that when you come out on the ice, every time you come out on the ice, we're going to give you 3 rests. And then what we're going to do is we're going to clean the ice a little better for you so you can really embarrass us out there.
Yeah.
Fuck me. I mean, Gretzky'd have another 300 or 400 points. Oh, easy.
You think so?
It wouldn't even be funny. And fuck yeah. Are you kidding me? Right today, just think of how hard everyone like played, like how, what the fights and the how hard it was to go in the corners and all of the shit that those guys endured to be able to be successful and have those points. And they go, well, the goalies were much, you know, didn't even wear equipment. Well, no, they didn't, but they weren't the same. But
right.
Guess what? All of the rules around it are so much easier to play. Like, holy shit.
Right.
And I mean, heaven forbid you ever tried to intimidate anybody now. Christ, you get the book thrown at you.
The question of fighting Chaser will never go away, okay? It will never go away from, you know, I agree. The games in the 80s, I'm watching them now with the virus, and they're more exciting. Yeah. But the question of it is always there. And I said, if you're going to bring up fighting, then you got to talk to a guy who was a fighter. So what's your take on that now, where the game is and that there is virtually no fighting compared to the day you played?
Yeah, I don't think we're going back to that because they can call it evolving or they can call it whatever they want to call it. But what I will tell you about the game is that, you know, you can't have it both ways. Like, intimidation is in sports, whether you like it or not. However you want to be intimidated, you can be intimidated. I don't know what you'd have to be intimidated about in hockey now compared to the way it was, but But it's still, whether it's the fear of speed, the fear of what, there is intimidation. You can be over respectful, and that's when it becomes intimidating. Okay, right. That's my opinion, and I don't think it's going to. I mean, it's not going to go back. You know, you just have too many people that, you know, there's case in points with head injuries, but and concussions, and obviously, you know, fights, they'll have concussions, less concussions than hits, but no one's going to bring that out. No one's going to say we're taking the contact out. They'll take the fighting out because that's an easy one. That's the gimme. But when you actually find out, I wonder how many fights the knockout hits take away from the game. How many guys actually wouldn't do it if they were had to be accountable for it? That's my question. But I will say this to you. It regardless of how it's perceived now, and, you know, I think there was a time where it became a little bit of a show instead of guys just, you know, really, like, this is where we have purpose.
Right.
I'm not begrudge any of the players that play now. I think it's easier to play now. It's just, I mean, it's not as, because, it's, I mean, it is. Like, just, there was a lot of sleepless afternoons. I mean, you know, if you were a young guy and you were bothered by that, there'd be a lot of sleepless afternoons if you were playing in the NHL, knowing you had to play in the Chicago Stadium in the old Chuck Norris division. Like, you know, it's pretty remarkable. And again, you know, it leads you back to, you know, I think Gene Olchek might have said this in the movie, during that movie too. He said, if someone told him it's a hard way to make an easy living.
Yeah, good.
And, you know, because we're pretty grateful for what we have, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But I'll tell you what, you have to do it every day, and it's a bitch.
Right.
And yet, the guys that were comfortable doing it, I, you know, I'm just not a big believer in blaming, you know, all my problems on the game. Like, I just don't. To me, you know, I'm lucky to have what I have in my life, and I owe it to the game.
Right. Right.
And it's brought me so much that I'm not a guy. I don't buy into the bullshit about the guys going, oh, my coach made me fight and I can't sleep at nights now because I was forced into, you know,
yeah.
If you got to the point to the NHL where you were fighting, you were there because you were tough.
Right.
And somewhere along the line, that was the role you had. You weren't going to be there 100%. Any other way.
Right.
You know, yeah. And it's too hard to play in the NHL. And the guys that get to the NHL, okay, they have to be able to play. They have to be able to play. It's impossible to be a guy. It's impossible. And I mean, it's absolutely 100% impossible not to be a decent player to be and play in the NHL.
Right.
I don't care what anybody says. You can't do it. It's just, it's too hard. The athletes are too good. And there's too much at stake for a team to just take you if you can't play.
Chaser, I always said this I've said this on the show a bunch of times, that every player that's in the NHL was a superstar at 10, 11, 12 years old, and not one of those players said, I'm going to be a grinder, I'm going to be a fighter. I mean, they were stars in their towns, in their cities, in their provinces. And then what happens. We get older. We get into the NHL. I came in as an offensive guy and ended up having to be a two-way guy, or wasn't going to play on a checking line. And that was it. It was just, I got converted.
Yeah, by the way, that was one of the most successful checking lines that were out there. When you guys, were you talking about when you played with Carbo? You guys had
Carbo and Mike Ducey. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. All three of us had 20, I think we had 70, averaged like 74 goals a year or something between the three of us.
Yeah.
It was phenomenal. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so Jimmy, to get back to your question, like, don't pretend to tell me what it's like.
Right.
Like, I hate when people say, well, it's this, and I want to say to them, like, really? Well, that's how it is? Well, that's great. I appreciate all your knowledge. It's like, you know, I say this all the time. Like, you know, you have people that I think I know what it's like to win the Stanley Cup as a player, because
right.
I've won at every level.
but I don't. I get to see what it's like. I'm even closer to seeing what it's like to win as a player because I got to win with the Blues this past year,
right,
which was phenomenal. The whole thing was unbelievable. I still don't know what it's like to win as a player, so I don't really know. I think I know, but I don't really know for sure. I don't for sure know what it's like to win the Stanley Cup as a player because I never won. Mm-hmm. Now, I've won in the minors, I've won in junior, and I'm lucky. I've won three national championships as an owner of a team, and so like I get the winning concept, but I don't really know what it's like to win the Stanley Cup as a player. So I got to refer to the guys that have, and it's the same thing as fighting. And I can tell you right now, I've had guys. I had one of the guys in the NHL discipline tell me, well, you know, and I said, listen, I just don't feel like anybody but players should be able to decide on the discipline. I don't believe there should be anybody in there making a decision based on, and not that I think that they get all of their answers from them or whatever, but I don't believe that anybody that never played the game should have any say in NHL discipline. That's my belief.
Right.
Right. And because you don't really know what it's like to put on the brakes or, yeah, did he stick his knee out on purpose? Or you can interpret the rule, but you don't really know what it's like to go through it unless you've done it. And the guy said to me, I've been in fucking 1,000 of these meetings. And I said, big fucking deal. I've been on 1,000 flights. They don't let me fly the fucking plane.
Right.
You know, like I don't know what it's like to fly the fucking plane.
Right.
Oh, fuck. That guy that Chaser's describing, that's the guy you tell him to turn the video on and off just to watch the infraction, not to make a judgment call. It's a fucking joke. If you went through every player that played the NHL or everyone playing in the NHL, they would agree with Chaser 1,000%. There wouldn't be one guy that would say, oh, no, I think we need a lawyer in there, or we need a guy who's watched 1,000 tapes and he now thinks he knows what he's doing. It has to be a player because the players know. I'm not a fighter, but I watched all the best fighters fight in my 16 years that were playing at that time. And God, I saw some horrific fights and I saw some great fights, and I know exactly what Chaser's talking about, but I'm not a fighter. So I don't, I can't say that, I was losing sleep in the afternoon because I was going to have to fight somebody, because I never even crossed my mind.
Right.
I knew what the shit was going on, but Chaser is so bang on that the discipline in the NHL level should be handled by players, and it should not be farmed out to freaking nerds that think they know it all.
And I'm not knocking I'm not picking a particular call or whatever. I'm just saying, and I'm not saying that, if it happens to be a friend of ours, George Peros, is doing it right now, and I'm not saying that he doesn't use his own judgment after a while. I just don't think that his judgment should be tainted in any way, shape, or form with somebody that's never gone through that process. Because to me, the only way to really know what someone's mind may have been thinking is to understand all of the things that go into it. Some of it's the stress of the game. Mm-hmm. Some of it's the timing of the game. Some of it is the instincts that you just happen to have, whether it's your arm because you think you're closer to a guy than you are when you follow through, to what was the intent or what happened leading up to it, and how where you may have caught a skate, an edge, whatever. I don't know what the incident is, but if you've had it happen to you, you understand it, and then you're like, okay, look, I can remember in Philadelphia when this happened, and it resulted in something that I wasn't proud of, but or you know what, that was a complete accident. Joey Koscher hit me from behind and he's one of my closest friends. He hit me from behind in New York, and I ended up missing like 6 weeks. It tore the ligaments in my back. Now, I can tell you, he almost beat the shit out of a New York cop trying to get in our locker room. And he got in our locker room, was in the training room with me. He didn't mean to hit me the way he hit me. And if you watch the tape, I actually get my feet tied up kind of in his skate as he comes in, but he's thinking I'm turning to the middle of the ice, and I don't see him. So he thinks I see him. So at the last second, I turn my back the wrong direction, which lots of guys do now.
Right.
You don't have, there's no brakes you can stop. There's just, you can watch it 100 times in slow motion and it looks awful. There's no way Joey Kosher hit me like that on purpose. I don't care what anybody says. One of my best, he would never do that. Well, as a matter of fact, he was so rattled by it, he was in our locker room. I mean, wow. That never happened.
Right.
You don't go in anybody's locker, especially tough guys. They're like, hey, you know, right. This bothered him. And so, like, I can guarantee you right now he'd be suspended for it. Now, can you get suspended when it was an accident? Yes, you can. You still made a mistake. But it looked, if you slowed it down, it looked like intent. It looked like all kinds of things that weren't there. And I knew it, right. You know, because I've been down that path before. I made a stupid mistake and turned the wrong way.
Right.
That's it. That was on me.
Incredible. I never heard that story.
We talked about it this summer. He just said, he goes, I can't, I'll never, we were joking about it. And he goes, listen, and Melrose was giving him a hard time because he went in the locker room to say, he goes, you didn't say sorry. Because we were like, he's like, come on. Oh. We said, sorry from where we're from, you know, like, and we were laughing. He was laughing about it. Joey's like, no, I seriously, he goes, I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed that it happened the way it happened. Plus he goes, you know, you think about it, about us all, our families knowing one another. He goes, I could tell the optics were bad. And so you have to be out there to understand when that could happen to you. And Russ, I'm sure you've played the game where you come through the middle of the ice and you've done something at the last second and swung through and, you know, and caught a guy, or maybe you got caught and hit and, you know, and a lot of the onus is going to be on you because guys don't know what direction you're going lots of times when you're coming with your head down, flying through the middle of the ice. So, you know, yeah. I don't know. I think you have to be able to have had those experiences to be able to make those decisions. That's just my opinion. And that goes for anything. So I, you know, I don't buy the writer that tells me, I don't buy into the writer that tells me that I was a goon in this hockey. There's no way anybody's intimidated and there's no use for it. And that there's no, what the fuck do you know about it? Right. I mean, the only time you've been in a locker room is when I'm in my underwear.
Right.
And you're going to tell me what the fuck I'm supposed to be doing when I fucking feel like I'm going to fight with somebody.
Right.
What a crock of shit that is.
The best line is, I've flown 1,000 times. It doesn't mean I can be the pilot. Yeah. That's the fucking best.
Yeah.
You know, I knew this would be a hard time to try and get stuff out of you, Chaser. Fuck, I knew it would be such a struggle. I said, fuck, this is going to be like pulling teeth. I'm really going to have to be on my game.
Fuck, I've had a birthday.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, Russ. I'll tell you what the problem is, Kelly. And I can only say, we have a partner. We've partnered with someone on this podcast, and the guy's great. And they do all the marketing for us. I'm going to lose my fucking job when he hears this interview. He's going to go, Jerome, you're out. Fucking Chaser's in. And, this is unbelievable. Kelly, this is the best. And
good news. Yeah. Hey, good news, buddy. I can't afford another fucking job.
Good. Okay. Before you go.
Every time I take on to one of these fucking projects, it costs me money. I know how this works.
Dear, at least you didn't have a gig like Jeremy Roenick, and he went on a podcast and then lost his fucking NBC gig, which was a drag.
Oh, but, my God.
Yeah. Hey, listen, I got to tell you, I mean, I'm not, you know, I think it's kind of funny that, and I love the podcast. Those guys do a great job. They've marketed the shit out of them.
Right.
But I find it funny that the league embraces them and then the league's employer fires them for something that the league is endorsed. Like, don't you find that funny?
Totally funny. Like, it was just totally upside down.
JR, well, you know, we're going to have these guys at All-Star Games and we're going to have, because they hit a demographic and a market and they've got all these followers. And these guys, they're brilliant at what they do and how they get people to watch them and everything.
Right.
But I'm going to fire a guy that's over the line on that. Everybody that's on there is over the line. So far there's only been, two coaches, a couple of announcers that have been fired so far for going on their podcast. If I worked in the league, I wouldn't do one fucking minute on that show. Right. I love those guys, but you're headed down a slippery slope when you get on that show.
Did anyone ever approach you, Chaser, about when Don Cherry got fired? I thought of your name right away if they would look for a replacement for that sort of thing, the Ron McLean gig. Did you ever get approached about that?
Yeah. No, you know what? I mean, I think they're trying to get away from that. I mean, they can control, you know, Berkey a little bit, so they have Brian Burke in there. You know, I think that's kind of the, you know, what they're, you know. I just don't, I don't think that they're, everyone's so damn self-conscious about anything that they might say that would offend somebody.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were looking for an excuse with Grapes, and they unfortunately got rid of him. And you know, and hey, you know, it's a tough time to be on the air right now when everybody's scrutinizing every damn thing you say. It was a good time for me to get out of broadcasting is what it was.
Listen, I lost my job because of it. I lost my radio job because of it. Said the wrong fucking thing. It was toast. Yeah. Before
that, and you were all coked up when you said it.
Well, I was on drugs and booze, but that's a small aside. That's a very small aside. Okay. Chaser, plug the movie. We talked about Chaser,
just so you know, Jimmy's been sober for 10 years now, right?
Yeah.
Jimmy, 9, 10?
10 years, man. Yeah, 10 years.
So we tease him, but we also were so proud.
Well, I think, don't you have an anniversary of stopping that every time, like, we're in Vegas, and it's like, when was the date? When's your actual date, your anniversary of stopping?
The date, I'll tell you when it is I was sitting beside you drinking at a blackjack table. And I said, I got to fucking quit. I got to quit. It was August 1st, 2010. So it's 10 years this August coming up.
I don't know where I was, but I was with you at one of them August because I remember us talking about it. And you said, yeah, it's the date of... And I don't know where we were, but I remember you and I talking about it. And good for you, man. I'm proud of you. If you don't get back to it during this quarantine, or I don't end up being like you, it'll be a fucking miracle.
That's right. By the way, you're a really good blackjack player, okay? And I've watched you play blackjack because I've had many laughs with you sitting there in that privé lounge in the Bellagio. Except you drive me fucking nuts. This is what he does, Rusty, when he plays blackjack, okay? So he'll get stiffed, okay? He'll get a 9-3, okay, and the dealer's showing queen or king, right? So the dealer's right into the deck to rip the card over, right? And like anyone would, take another card. Chaser goes, up, hang on. Whoa, don't do that yet. You think I want an 8 on this third, and it's just, I'm going, what the fuck are you doing? You think I want an 8? And then he goes, no. No.
That'd be greedy.
Okay, now we're fucking hammered. That's how long ago it is. He goes, give me a 5. Give me a fucking 5. Funniest guy ever. Chaser, plug the movie before you go. We talked about fighting and all that, but tell us about Guardians, Ice Guardians, before you hang up here.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's been out there for a bit now, and I think it's actually... I found out that it's being watched quite regularly just by going on social media and what people have reached out and said, wow, I've heard about this movie, never had time to watch it. Holy shit, is it ever good? And it makes you feel good that you know Adam Scorgi, I assume.
Yes.
It just makes you feel good that you've done, like, Adam put a lot of work into this thing, and I remember him coming to me and saying, no, I want to do this. And I said, I know another guy that wants to do, tell me he wants to do a fighting movie. I said, and then by the end of it, you'll be telling me what it's like. And he goes, no, I want you to tell the story. I want you to get the guy. And I go, okay. I said, and then I said, but that's not what happens. Like, what happens is you guys go about doing your own thing. And then you put the, he goes, I said, I'll tell you what. You let me executive produce it, and I get to say which guys are on the movie. I get the Knicks guys. If there's guys that I think are full of shit that were fighters, they're not coming on. They're not going to be a part of it.
Right.
And he said that's fair.
Cool.
So he had about 3 or 4 different guys that I said nope, he doesn't get to be on. He was full of shit.
Right,
and then so.
Tell us who.
Come on. Who did you flick? Who did you fucking flick?
No, I can't.
No,
Russ Courtnell.
I basically just said, and then when it was done, you know, obviously at the end there where the crybaby there at the end there, I said every time at the end of the movie, you know, when obviously I was emotional and I said to him, okay. He goes, well, that's not going to be the end. You know, like, he goes, we're just doing that just because you're watching the screen, you know, right now. And I'd say, Adam, I'm serious. Don't fucking put that in the movie.
Right, right.
And I guess the whole time him and the director were saying, him and Brett Harvey were saying, oh no, that's definitely going to be the end. He doesn't. I don't give a shit what he says. He can say all the other things he wants. Right. That's going to be the end. And they freaking put it on the end. And as it turned out, I hope you get to see, I hope you can figure out Netflix there, Jimmy, or pay your fucking bill. But
I will.
once you do and see it, you know, shoot me a text and see what your thoughts are on it. But it was pretty, it ended up being pretty cool that not only, you know, not only like people had never, we did a viewing thing out of Gozer with the friends of ours put it together, Callahan's, and
right.
We had a big party and a bunch of people came over, but not what you would call hockey fans, just friends from, you know, from our other life sort of thing. And to watch the reaction of the people when it was over and hear them come over and talk to you about it and everything was, it made it worthwhile because it was really, really well done. And I think that, you know, and again, we can go back to parts of the movie, but I like guys like Brian McGrattan, when he says in the movie, he says, listen, I didn't do drugs and alcohol because I was a fighter. I didn't do drugs and alcohol so they could play the game and worry, you know, fighting. Mm-hmm. I did drugs and alcohol because I'm a drug addict and an alcoholic.
Right. Right.
Yeah. You know, he goes, I'm not going to blame it on fighting.
Right.
Right.
Good for him.
He goes, that's easy to do. I could, you know, I could be that guy. I'm not going to be that guy. That's not why I did it.
Right.
I have a problem. And he goes, and that's the thing. Like, and so to get guys that actually have done it, like we just talked about, that actually have, you know, been in the battle and said, in saying, that's bullshit. That's not why this goes on. And, you know, the code, what, you know, yeah, there's a code. But at some point, you can bury the code if somebody's taken care of, being taken advantage of. It doesn't matter.
Right.
He's your teammate. And right. The fact that you're willing to sacrifice what you're willing to sacrifice for your teammate, for the guy beside you, and give up, you know, well possibly, who knows what, right? You're willing to give up maybe a hospital visit, maybe you know, losing your teeth,
mm-hmm.
breaking your jaw, whatever it may be, so that your teammate can feel better out there. That's a hell of a sacrifice. And the only guys that look at it like that are your teammates.
Right.
See, so that's what's the most important thing. The guy that's in row four that's paying, you know, $20,000, I appreciate that guy for his ticket, but I don't fight for that guy.
Right, right.
I don't give a shit what he thinks.
Yeah.
You know, I'm doing it because I don't want my teammates to be taken advantage of. And that was the whole point of the movie. And that was the whole, you know, I mean, the doctors, everyone that are on there, I thought did a phenomenal job of giving every angle that you could possibly have.
I know you're passionate because speaking of that lounge, we were standing in one night and the conversation was getting pretty heated about some hockey things. I forget who it was. Someone pissed you off and I said, fuck, Chaser's going to drop him here. He's going to punch Mike Keenan in the fucking head. I forget who it was.
Keenan, too, wasn't it?
I think it was. Do you remember that?
I remember.
He pissed you off, and he nudged me, and he goes, watch me get him going here. And I said, fuck, you better be careful. He's fucking, I remember that. You were really pissed off, you know, what he said.
Mike, to me, was, you know, he was over the line with the way he handled a lot of guys. And I didn't like it. I didn't like the way he handled my situation, you know, and he traded me and told me that he didn't trade me. He left me off, left me on waivers and said he didn't have time to trade me.
Right. Oh,
it was after a lockout. Yeah. And, I had gone home for my grandmother's funeral, and Mike had said that, you know, he had told me that when I said, listen, I'll meet you guys in, we're going to Vail for camp. And he said, yeah, absolutely. Family's first. Like, that's the most important thing.
Right.
So I said, okay, well, you know, my grandmother had kind of raised us when my dad had passed away young. And I said, I got to go home. I got to go to this funeral. So there's no ifs, ands, or buts. So he's like, of course, you know, it's family and family's first. And that's what we are, one big family. And he went on and on and on about, typical Mike bullshit. And then the next thing you know, I get back. I'm actually in Vail before the team is in Vail. I mean, I got a flight that got me in before they did, but I wasn't with the team.
and to fly there. And then he didn't say a word to me for a couple of days. And then he said, I'm putting you on waivers. He goes, I made a decision, and we got to have guys around here that'll sacrifice for each other. He goes, you know, we can't have guys on the team that'll just take off for a wedding or whatever.
Jesus. Yeah. Nice.
A wedding. So, like, when he was nudging you to get me going, he's lucky that he didn't lay beside that table in the patio.
Right. Hey, Chaser, you know, when Penny's mom died, same thing. And Jeff went up to Keener and said, Mike Keener, and said, my mother-in-law died. And he's like, you can't go. And he didn't get to go to that funeral either. And
wow.
I had two deaths in our family. I think that, you know, important people, and I didn't even freaking ask the coach because I knew the answer.
Right.
I was in Montreal, and I was Pat Burns. There's no fucking way Pat going, oh, yeah, you're going to fly to Calgary for a funeral.
It was the way it was because that's what guys exactly. Like that Mike thought he had to do to be successful. And I don't, you know, I mean, that's all he knew. I mean, Mike, in my opinion, couldn't coach after the 2-way contract went away, because once they started telling guys everyone was on 1-way contract. Well, when you can't threaten to send a guy to the minors and you can't coach anymore, well, then you're fucked. You might as well leave the game anyway.
Right.
And that's basically what happened. I mean, Mike had, I think his goal when he was in St. Louis was just in case the world came to an end, he wanted to have one guy in the air at all times from the minors. So at least if the world blew up, then fuck, there'd be somebody surviving in St. Louis in the air.
We got to go, Chaser. This was fantastic. This is the best interview, hands down, that we've had so far. And I'm totally excited what people are going to think when they hear it.
I guess it was your first one, eh? Their first guest. I appreciate it, man.
No. You were fucking eighth down the list. You were eighth. There were seven guys who said no. I said, get a hold of fucking Chaser. He'll do anything. He'll fucking talk for hours. Fuck me. Get him on the line. This is unbelievable, man. This is great, Kelly. God bless, man. And Ice Guardians is out there alive and well. And good luck to you. And we're going to get you on again, if that's okay, to repeat everything so Russ can understand it. Okay, Kelly. Take care, brother.
Take care, boys.
The Suspendables is a weekly hockey series with Jim Jerome in Edmonton and Russ Cortinel in L.A. A new episode every Tuesday morning on Wooshka, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow The Suspendables on Facebook and Twitter. Reach us at thesuspendables@yahoo.com. And of course, we appreciate you sharing this podcast with your group of friends.